Welcome to the Farcast. Over 200 episodes and still going strong, bringing you experts and insiders to help you navigate the investing landscape. Now, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week, May the 12th. Here we go. Middle of the quarter, earnings season has come in pretty well. And boy, if you missed, you were punished. Right out in the woodshed you went, and you've stayed there. You've stayed there. Looks like the fear trade is back in control on Wall Street. If we don't like even the sound of something, if somebody breaks a twig somewhere behind us, we're going to sell. Sell, sell, sell is the order of the day. Isn't it interesting, ladies and gentlemen, how we've gone from buy, buy, buy? I just think of Cramer every time I hear these things with a sell, sell, sell. Ladies and gentlemen, there are companies that are earning money, that are expanding their market share, that are meeting consumers' needs, and they are profitable. Yes, markets are going to go through a difficult time. They do that periodically. Markets go down. I know it's odd. And economies contract. Fed is fighting inflation. And the only thing, ladies and gentlemen, the one thing you need to pay attention to is the Federal Reserve. Ignore all the other noise. As long as the Federal Reserve is removing accommodation, volatility will be with us. Profits will be under pressure. And we'll see what happens with prices at the pump and prices at the grocery store. They typically take a while. For all of those new investors who want this over yesterday, I think you really need to go to the beach because this is not going to be over that quickly. We could be putting in a near-term bottom, according to Farr here. That's big Farr opinion. Could be putting in a near-term bottom, but we'll probably see lower as time goes on. The Fed has said they're going to be here removing accommodation through the balance of this year. Don't think that we're getting off the hook anytime during the balance of this year. Just Farr's opinion, which means gird yourself emotionally. Make sure that your portfolio owns solid companies with solid balance sheets. And this is when long-term investors earn their money because it's not going to be fun. Isn't fun today? It's not going to get fun. And this happens and we get through it. And this is how you do make money. We're going to find out what one of the best investors on Wall Street thinks about this from our friend Jim Labenthal, partner at Cerity Partners, contributor on CNBC, the guy on the halftime report, as we say on the Farcast, listen to Labenthal. Welcome back, Jim.
Oh boy, I really appreciate that intro, Michael. I always appreciate it, but even more so when we're in tough times. And this is a time that you and I and our listeners and our clients, our investors need to get through, and we will. Let's talk about it.
Let's talk about it, Jim. We've seen a very emotional market, certainly through the month of April and into the beginning of May. People were surprised by the Federal Reserve seemingly saying 50 basis points to where we rallied, and then we fell 1,000 points. I still don't get that one. I've seen the Treasury, of course, Jim, back off with yields getting up to that 320, 325 level. Now we're in the 280s again this morning, rallying back, people buying Treasuries. And with inflation data yesterday that was as expected, if not hoped, and I think that was the key, inflation data, CPI was expected, but not what we were hoping for, and the wishful thinking didn't pan out, and stocks sold off again. What the hell's going on?
Quite a list you just put together. Not quite tongue-in-cheek do I mention that crypto didn't come up, but you probably didn't have time.
Crypto's still falling like a rock.
I mean, it didn't come up in your list of things facing the market. No. But let me answer your question, because we can go through every single one of those, or we can simply describe the market this way. This is a market that's trading on emotions and not fundamentals. And worse, it's trading on the emotions of fear, which can be very dangerous. This can be a moment in the market where people say, oh my God, I can't take it anymore. and sell me out. And when I say people, I'm not talking about hedge fund managers. I'm not talking about big asset management companies. I'm talking about the individual investor who normally listens to you and I. And I worry about them. I worry about them making a mistake, turning a temporary loss into a permanent loss by selling at ultra low prices. As you pointed out, certainly can go down further from here. But I do think when you look at the fundamentals, which I'm going to cover in just one second, that you can feel pretty comfortable that whether it's a month, 6 months, a year from now, we should be seeing nicely higher prices. But this is a market that's ignoring the fundamentals. It's ignoring the fundamentals in the big picture, such as, okay, people are worried about the economy. Look at how strong the labor market is. It's hard to get a recession when you're creating 400,000 jobs a month. And yes, the Fed's raising interest rates will have an effect, but that's down the line. And it's the emotions versus fundamentals are seen in company-specific reports. So Disney reported last night. There was a lot to be positive about, whether it was the resumption of theme park traffic, whether it was the resumption of movies, whether it was better than expected streaming subscriber additions. But in this market that's trading on emotion and not fundamentals, what was focused on was the spending to build streaming subscribers and the potential that maybe next quarter's results are not going to be as good as this quarter's. Folks, Michael and I are in this for far more than a quarter. And when you're in this for far more than a quarter, it is the fundamentals that matter, not fear and emotion. So please try not to make the emotional decision that you'll regret later.
Jim, I've talked about this for a long time, years and years and years. There are three psychological stages to every market cycle. And the psychological stages for the bear market, first are disbelief. When markets start going down, think back into January, maybe we'll go towards February, March, and things start to sell off. The Fed might really mean it this time. Then there's acceptance. So there's denial, acceptance, and then there's fear. So I think we are not really in the fear stage yet. We're getting fear. But this is part of the capitulation stage into, wow, this is really going to be bad for a while. Fear is when people just sell and say, I never want to own a stock again. And that's when you want to have a little bit of cash and buy everything you can. And if you don't have cash, at least, as Jim says, don't be selling anything. There's also a corresponding news cycle, reaction to news psychologically during a bear market. During a bear market, all bad news is embraced. Oh, and we chew on it and we roll it around our tongues and we knit our fingers together about all of the bad news and we dismiss good news. If you say something positive during a bear market cycle, you are Pollyannish. You're not a serious person. You don't get it. So to try and do what Labenthal and I do, ladies and gentlemen, which is call balls and strikes, we really try and we've learned over a lot of years, and I mean decades, to not be swayed by those emotions. And we feel them. I promise we feel them. But we stop and say, is this a good number or is it not a good number? Is Disney going out of business or not going out of business? What do those streamers mean? Those streaming subscriptions mean? What do the return to the theme parks mean? What's the impact from Asia? And when we sit down and do that sort of analysis, we can then come to a rational decision long-term about Disney for our clients and for ourselves as an investment. That's what we have to do and not get caught up in, you know, the world's going to end tomorrow. I've heard at different times in my career, Jim, people really suggesting the world was going to end. And so far, they've all fallen a bit short, don't you think?
Well, I do. And let me parse a little bit of what you're saying, because not only, and I use that term with clients that the world is not going to end. There's another term that comes up also, which is people saying, well, these times are unprecedented.
This is different.
Yeah. This is different.
We've never seen this before.
It is always slightly different. but it's always unprecedented. And folks, I don't mean to make light of the turmoil that's going on, and I certainly don't mean to make light of the emotions that you're feeling, but I do want to put some perspective to it. I believe this is a correction, not the start of a bear market. Let me start there, okay? And what the definition is technically is, you know, a bear market goes down more than 20%, a correction goes down 10 to 20%. But the real definition, the practical definition, is how long it takes to recover. Bear markets grind it out for years, and it takes years to get back to the peak. Corrections are usually start and over within a 12-month period. I think that's where we are right now, but people are saying this is unprecedented. You've got the threat of nuclear war, and you've got hyperinflation, and it could be the Great Depression. Okay, at prior corrections, similar words are used. So if, for instance, I go back to 2011, that's just one correction, late 2011, markets were off almost 20%, almost a full bear market, much like today. It was unprecedented because the European Union was about to disintegrate under the weight of the peripheral economies. And we had Fukushima, and we were still reeling from the after. Fukushima was the nuclear disaster in Japan, right, folks. And we were still reeling from the after effects of the financial crisis. This was unprecedented. When I hear those words, it's almost comforting because I've been here so many times before. And to go back to where you started, Michael, unprecedented times occur, but they don't lead to the end of the world. The world will be just fine. And I do think this is a correction. One last thing, if I may, Michael, you can always edit this out later on the cutting room floor.
Never, never. We listen to Labenthal.
Corrections have an insidious effect that you referred to, or an insidious impact that you referred to, which is there are multiple bottoms, yes, bottoms. And each one of them sucks people in, gives them hope, and that hope is then trashed when the next bottom hits. And with each successive decimation of hope, the despair gets deeper and deeper. Right now, that despair is pretty deep. It's hard to call a bottom, but I will say the despair level that I'm hearing indicates to me that we are close.
I had an old pro friend of mine for years who was a chartist. He was a technician, and he had a sign on his wall, and he says, if you're ready to call a bottom, don't. That was the sign. If you're ready to call a bottom, don't. And it was all big caps that said don't. Jim, I'm not necessarily going to disagree with you, but I want to amend. If this is a correction and not the beginning of a bear market, it that doesn't make a whole lot of difference to what you're going to do or what I'm going to do. I mean, because while Jim has this thesis, well thought, well founded, and I may or may not agree with it, that doesn't matter. We see the direction. We're pretty clear that we've got the big highlights about what's going on. We got this. We've seen this. We know what's going on right now. We don't know how this ends. And it could be, as Jim suggests, something more abbreviated, or it could be something longer. In either case, we have to prepare ourselves emotionally the same way. We have to remember our discipline. We have to remember the importance of being dispassionate. I think it's so much more important to be dispassionate in a down market than it is an up market. So you cannot get carried away in a down market and be thrown into cash, because I promise years later, you will regret it. I've seen it so many times, and it always feels good to sell into a falling market. Jim, how do you fight those emotions?
With experience. And that experience comes not from telling myself not to sell, but I have clients, you have clients, some of them may be listening to this podcast. And I know they are feeling terrible amounts of fear, and it actually breaks my heart. What my goal is to make them understand that an investment decision, namely to sell on the basis of the fear that they're feeling, is highly likely to be a decision they regret and rue for years to come. When I was 20 years younger, I didn't have the experience base with which to say that. I'm not 20 years younger, I'm the age I am now. And it's with that age and experience that I give the greatest counsel that I can give, which is don't take a temporary loss and turn it into a permanent loss. Mm-hmm. If you do, I would liken it to you just missed the train as it's pulling out of the station. And for years, you will be chasing after that train, always in sight, trying to get back into the market and always just out of reach. I can't tell you this is the bottom. I've made that mistake. I think you were speaking that aphorism to me directly, Michael.
Never.
And
never.
It's okay. I've made that mistake. But the mistake I won't make is selling at depressed prices. These are depressed prices.
Right. You know, I did have that client, and we're running out of time, and I need to get your Fred and Ethel best advice if we haven't already given it. I'm remembering clients from 2008 and 2009 who called in and sold out their entire portfolio. And it was October of 2008. We were very, very low. And I begged with them. It was an older husband, younger wife. The husband was about 15 years older than his wife. They had younger children. They had about $1.5 million or so in the markets, and they needed the growth. His income was slowing because he was that much older. And they insisted. They just couldn't stand it and insisted and said, look, we know. And clients will do this, Jim, right? They'll say, we know, Mr. Farr, you're telling it's the wrong thing to do. We know that we'll probably regret it. Get us to cash. And you say, yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. And you do it. And then 3 years later, like clockwork, they called back and said, you know, and when they do this at our firm, we say, fine, we'll put you in cash. You're still a client. We're going to stop charging you on the account, of course. Sit in cash and, you know, call us. We're going to continue to give you counsel. 3 years later, the market was some 3,000 or 4,000 points higher, and they're ready to get back in. And they did. And he has since passed away. I need to talk with that widow. And I know she's out of her mind because she doesn't really have what she's going to need to continue the lifestyle they were living without his earnings, even his limited earnings. And so Social Security is not going to replace it. It's a bit tragic, but people will tell you that they know they're doing something wrong and they still want to do it. And I wish we had, Jim, do you have some advice for those clients that's better than the advice I've been able to muster over the years?
Well, let me start by saying I've had the same experiences. I do think it's tragic when those client calls come in.
Yep.
And at this age, I do my best to talk them out of it. At the end of the day, it's their money. But I agree with everything you said. In terms of the advice to our lovely Fred and Ethel.
Yes.
You may not like what I'm about to say, but is the most heartfelt advice I can give right now. Don't watch so much TV and read so much news on the internet. And I'm not saying stick your head in the sand. I'm not saying be a dope and don't pay attention. But this is a time that media absolutely gets frothy with how much bad news and what the headlines are that they can write and provoke that fear in you. It does exactly to you what you don't want to have done with you. You don't want to have that fear stoked. Try not to read so much of the news. It's not going to change your investment decision for the better. I can almost promise you that. I think Michael can too. Go on with your lives. Think about what things are going to look like a year from now. They're likely to look a heck of a lot better. And frothing about and twisting and turning and fretting about and wringing our hands about what today's headline is not going to help you.
Jim Labenthal is a partner at Cerity Partners, a contributor on CNBC. He's going to be on later today. Tune in and turn it up, folks, when Labenthal comes on. Jim, thank you so much for being with us this week. Again, you provide such wonderful information to our listeners. And ladies and gentlemen, I'll tell you one more thing. When I get to do this broadcast and I get to talk with guys like Labenthal and Mahaffey and coming up, Jeff Lacker, president of the Fed, this helps me get my head right. I'm thinking, this is what we do in investment committees a lot, to really discuss how we look at markets and how we're talking with clients, and I learn things. So thank you, Jim. It really does help my process too.
Likewise, and I really enjoy being on the show. It's very helpful. Let's move forward, all of us, including our listeners, and especially our listeners. Let's move forward into a brighter future.
Amen. We'll be back with Dan Mahaffey. Is Vladimir Putin really that sick? He had a blanket across his legs and he was stumbling. And who do we get if Putin goes? When we come back on the Farcast.
We're glad you could join us this week on the Farcast. Now back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. Great segment with Jim Labenthal. He's so calm and he thinks so clearly and he thinks for the long term. As I said, ladies and gentlemen, I listen to Labenthal. I also listen to our great Dan Mahaffey, our senior political analyst on the Farcast, also director of policy at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, a Washington think tank. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, Michael. Great as always to be talking with you.
Really happy that you're here. So we've got stuff going on in D.C., still going on in, of course, Ukraine. Let's start with Ukraine. There were photos of Vladimir Putin, Dan, with a blanket covering his legs and limping at the World War II remembrance earlier this week. And then kind of rambling speech looked troubling. Is he ill? Are you hearing any confirmation of that? What's going on?
Well, even before the war, there were long concerns about his health. You see the change in his appearance, his demeanor,
puffy,
of course. Yeah,
he
does. Steroid patient. If you've ever had a family member who is on those, you'd recognize that.
And what's the speculation for what sort of disease?
Speculations of different cancers. Parkinson's disease has been another one. There's various things that have been thrown around. None of them great diagnoses for him. Look, certainly he looks weak. Certainly their advances have not been sustained. The Russian military is looking weaker than ever. And I think it raises a good question. Do they escalate? Do they use more advanced weaponry? Do they get more brutal? I think we've seen that in some areas where they've tried to advance, where they've launched missile attacks on Odessa and other parts in Western Ukraine. That said, no, he does look weak. This is not going the way it is. The Western aid is coming. Congress just approved, I think it's going to be nearly $40 billion in additional aid from the U.S. to Ukraine. Where this goes from here, look, does the military remove him? I don't know. I don't know who.
All of this too, Dan, while his forces are close to bogging down in Donbass and his tanks and aircraft are dwindling, his air force is in tatters. I mean, how does he escalate? He doesn't have the weapons.
Well, nuclear.
Free to escalate, does he?
Nuclear would be how
so
they.
So nuclear is the answer, and
right,
that,
and that's
that, could it happen, or can his generals stop him?
Well, his generals may stop him. It would be who in the inner circle realizes that no matter what happens, Russia is a pariah for decades, if not centuries, if they do that.
Yeah, the part of what he's doing now is ruining a lot of Russia's future. In dealing with the rest of the world, as you've said, the U.S. is going to ramp up spending. NATO is completely united on this,
right? And expanding, likely to include Sweden and Finland. I think that's an announcement we'll hear if in the coming weeks, if not week. All this stuff moving in a way that strengthens the Western alliance that Putin fears so much.
How does this end? And any greater clarity? I mean, are we still talking about this in the fall?
Look, the simplest way to look at it is that we are still talking about it because the Russian playbook is that this bogs down. It becomes sort of a trench warfare. Look, World War I went on for years without people seeing a clear path to victory. So, look, the Russians can dig in unless there is that sort of deus ex machina coup type scenario. But again, who replaces him? There's not a clear person of an opposing ideology waiting in the wings to take power.
I think you've called this wishful Western thinking that somehow we'll get rid of Putin
and Xi Jinping's about to leave leave office, all those kinds of things. Yeah.
Yeah. Xi Jinping might not. Well, why don't we go ahead and move to the Southeast then in our discussion? And I don't mean Georgia or South Carolina. I'm.
This is not about to become a football podcast.
Well, we could do that sometime. The dogs are serious this year, by the way. The dogs, those Georgia dogs are serious. Let's go to the southeast of Russia, to China. And we are seeing increased shutdowns in China, COVID shutdowns. All of these things, ladies and gentlemen, are affecting us economically. The longer this conflict carries on in Ukraine, the higher those fuel prices are going to stay, the higher the grain prices and other commodity prices are going to stay. That doesn't ease up until that gets solved. So there's great right. pressure for that region. Now we go to China, and they still have huge shutdowns as they're shutting down cities and extending the shutdown in Shanghai. Is that right?
Extending the shutdown in Shanghai, extending the supply chain disruptions you've seen in Shanghai. It's getting even stricter, according to some folks, that if there's one positive test in an entire high rise, that it gets locked down. You've also seen
Do that again. There's one positive COVID test.
We'll extrapolate that to Washington, D.C. Imagine one positive COVID test in the swanky Watergate condos, and everyone there would then go on lockdown.
For a couple of weeks.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
And with groceries delivered, hopefully, twice a day by the government.
Well, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. Perfect. So, no, the one you see that they've continued to double down on this policy, the WHO itself has said that this is a counterproductive policy given the Omicron, nature of Omicron and the treatments available. But it ultimately comes, this is entirely politics. One is, that you can't, you can't dispute the Xi Jinping tactic of zero COVID. And they'll acknowledge it. And I'll say there's a real meaning behind this. There are far too many elderly Chinese. It would overwhelm their healthcare system if Omicron did run rampant. But also at the same time, China has refused Western mRNA vaccines because they're not invented in China. They've dragged their feet on the antiretroviral drugs that are now available here. So many of the tools that are available around the world are not being used in China because they are not Chinese, and in the Xi Jinping made in China mindset, that's not acceptable.
Okay. Well, this is slowing.
It slows down the rest of the world.
And it's shutting down a lot of the plants, a lot of the manufacturing. Wait, what did you tell me? There was a study April 27th to April 30th. What was it?
Yes, it was a survey of the Shanghai Japanese Commerce and Industry Club that said 63% of their factories had yet to reopen during that period.
63% of factories yet to reopen. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're not going to get the stuff we need for manufacturing here. A bunch of different CEOs during earnings season have been talking about when they see the end of the supply chain issues. Most all are 2023, many are 2024, and a good number are saying, I haven't any idea, but I don't see that ending anytime soon. Dan, let's move while we have time back to the United States.
Yes.
United States, we have Roe versus Wade. We also have Title 42. Let's go to Roe versus Wade first. I was giving a talk in Nashville this morning. I'm back in Washington. But they were asking about the hot issue in D.C. I said, well, the hot issue is the Supreme Court dealing with overturning Roe v. Wade. And both the Democrats and the Republicans are a titter, just waiting for the other party to really screw this up so they can come in and gain a great advantage about the election. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of discussion about what anybody really doing anything about Roe versus Wade. It'll go back to the states, I guess. Did I do that correctly, Dan? I mean, I'm sorry to be so cynical, but that's what I hear from these folks.
Great. I think you've seen this bombshell. This is an earthquake politically that the draft was leaked from Alito's chamber. But you're right that each party has done this. They've dug in. This inspires the partisans of both stripes. And I think it leaves a lot of the middle perplexed, dealing with a very squeamish issue that they thought was resolved in many ways. And also is a reminder, too, that this issue of personal choice, of life and death, and very complex and emotional topics are perhaps the worst things you can try and answer in a political binary of yes, no, or banned or not banned. And that's what we're being pushed to, though, by these rulings. And what we're seeing now, this outgrowth of laws in these various states that are challenging, you know, what it means for women's healthcare and access to what some will say is a human right.
These are crucial issues. The issue that the Supreme Court seems to be dealing with is it's funny because it gets a bit muddled down. The original issue that I understood was with Roe versus Wade as to why it might have been inappropriate was that it was sort of the court legislating. and making policy and making law. Is that what it was about? And what is Justice Alito trying to say now?
Well, I think we'd be on this podcast for hours and have a back and forth. I think what Alito is saying, though, is that the original finding was poorly rooted. It supplanted the will of the legislature with that of the judiciary, and therefore it's time to fix this. That's the gist of his finding that he's putting forward, his ruling. That said, look, I think either party, again, it's going to increase the emotions. We already see that. It's increased the rhetoric. It's a topic where we've already seen people turn to violence in the past, not long before this decision. So it is just adding to the culture war momentum for 2022. But I also see it not resonating with many voters who are still far more focused on the economy, on pocketbook issues than this, because as groundbreaking as this is, the political reality is that this doesn't affect all of the population.
Right. A CNN and poll said it wasn't really sticking on the Republicans or against the Democrats at this point. It wasn't showing much advantage either side. Let's go quickly, and I'm out of time, Dan. Title 42.
Right.
Can you quickly explain? This is about immigration, folks, and the restrictions at the border.
Yeah, Title 42 is an authority under public health rules that actually allows the administration to speed up deportations at the border and streamline some of the processes of getting illegal migrants out. Now, they've talked about pulling away this authority, and it's something that is quite controversial. Look, the pandemic is still going on. Immigration, securing the border, still a hot button issue for many independents. There's plenty of moderate Democrats who do not support the Biden administration on this, like Senator Kelly from Arizona, Senator Sinema. What the Republicans are going to try and do is make this a vote. If there's going to be more COVID money, they also want there to be a vote on Title 42. That is holding up the money, but it is something where the administration is trying to satisfy its immigration allies on the left by removing this ability to get migrants out faster by removing that. But it's putting moderate Democrats in a lot of discomfort in a midterm year.
What we know, I guess, for sure, is that we look at the numbers, and over the past 2.5-3 years since COVID began, we are down about 2 million immigrants. Million who would have otherwise, under normal times, immigrated to the
right, and those are the numbers based on legal immigration. So visas holders, legal immigrants. You know,
but
when you're talking about a workforce,
we've got a decline in the U.S. population.
Right.
The growth rate turned negative for the U.S. population, and GDP growth. See, we're talking about numbers, and we're talking about the economy here too. GDP growth is defined as the growth in the number of workers plus the growth in productivity. And we don't have any growth in the number of workers. In fact, we've got huge employment. Unemployment is as robust as it's been. We've got like 11 million job openings right now unfilled, and we can't get people in. We can't get people in to work, and not having immigration right now is costing the U.S. in terms of GDP growth. So that's 2 million workers we would have had that we don't have right
now. And Michael, it's hard to, I'd love someone to calculate this multiplier, and I'm sure there's a great economist who has the multiplier too of the migrants who come in and start industries, are entrepreneurs. You know, when I talk to tech executives, the biggest thing they'll tell me is, I need the talent from overseas because they're also gonna help make future American innovations.
There are a lot of things that recommend, Dan, immigration, but basically we need more workers, and we have the job openings. And 2 million fewer workers in the U.S. is an economic problem.
Right.
And because, ladies and gentlemen, stick with me just for one more second as I do this, because we have those fewer workers, we're going to pay more for the workers we have. And that's what's feeding a lot of the inflation that we're seeing. Wage inflation is going to be with us for quite a while. There's something government can do about this, and they can normalize immigration. When you see you've got a real economic problem and you see an answer, you look, it's a supply and demand thing. We need a supply of workers. We've got demand. How do we get more workers? We've got to figure out how to open that spigot legally for immigration, mm-hmm. says Farr. That's not a political comment.
We need legal immigration. We need a secure border. You can hold those two thoughts in your head and you can make policy that way. But both parties like to use immigration as something to bash the other party with rather than see it as a problem to solve.
Dan Mahaffey is the director of policy at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress and the senior political analyst on the Farcast now in season 5. Hell, it's going to be a few months. We're going to start season 6 in the fall. Amazing. Dan, thanks so much for being with us. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to come back with Dr. Jeffrey Lacker, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, one of the brightest leading economic minds, not only in this country, in the world. When we come back, we're going to figure this out and ask Jeff what all of this inflation and CPI and everything else means when we come back on the Farcast.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr. Thank you for joining us on the Farcast. And now, back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. Terrific segments tonight and this morning. We've done this over a couple of days. Jim Labenthal on the markets, Dan Mahaffey, and what's going on around the world. Now, ladies and gentlemen, probably the most important conversation you are going to hear this quarter or in the next 6 months at least. Dr. Jeffrey Lacker, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. He has been a professor, an advanced senior professor in various chairs throughout his career. Also a great friend of mine. Jeff, welcome back to the Farcast.
Pleasure to be with you again, Michael.
We are really glad you're here. Jeff, we've seen rates react very oddly. We've seen the 10-year Treasury spike well up to 3.2%. We've gotten into that range. We've seen inflation come in, CPI data this morning at 8.3%. Markets didn't like that. The Fed has raised rates twice, 75 basis points, and yet the 10-year is up to that 3% level. The Fed says they're going to raise rates again 50 basis points and then maybe level off. What does the Fed have to do here? What's going on? Is inflation going to stop?
I think they'll get it down eventually. The question is when, but I think we're in for a bumpy road. I think we're in for a volatile market. And I think the kind of volatility we've seen the last couple of days is going to be typical. The situation is that the Fed's promised to bring inflation down, but they don't know when and how rapidly they can do it. They haven't decided yet. They're facing some challenges coming up. Can they do this without causing a recession? It seems very unlikely. And I think the broad consensus is that it's extremely unlikely that they're going to be able to bring inflation down to 2% within the, or close to 2%, let's say under 3% by the end of next year without inducing a recession. The basic dynamics here are that the method of reducing inflation is to reduce the growth of demand.
Yes.
To bring it more in line with supply, and in fact, to create a little bit of slack to put downward pressure on margins, downward pressure on wages, and thereby bring the overall rate of inflation down. So to do it, they're going to have to weaken spending to some extent. The question is, can they weaken spending and labor markets enough to bring inflation down without also spiraling us into a recession?
And if you're going to weaken spending, it basically means you're going to put further pressure on the consumer so the consumer can't create as much demand. Is that right?
That's right. That's how they do it. Right.
And the U.S. economy is driven 2/3 at 70% or so, 68%, by that consumer. So if they put pressure on that consumer, how do we not go into recession if they really try to stop this level of inflation? 8.3%. This is serious stuff. Yeah.
And it's a kind of a knife edge they're walking here, because the historical record is clear that the unemployment rate never goes up by more than 0.5 of a percentage point without going up over 2 or 3%.
Say okay one more time.
The unemployment rate doesn't go up above its previous trough by more than 0.5 of a percentage point, right? So a percentage point without us going into a recession, essentially, without it going up by 2 percentage points or 3 percentage points, without there being a recession. So they're looking to nudge the unemployment rate up a little bit without nudging it up too much. And that's really tough to do because of the lags involved in monetary policy. You raise interest rates and it takes time for that to affect spending.
Right.
But so, that's the path they're trying to achieve.
Two parts that are concerning to me. So I heard Jay Powell say in his comments the other day, he was asked how much of the inflation was coming from the shutdowns and supply chain issues coming out of China. And of course, the war in Ukraine that was limiting, again, causing supply chain issues there. And he basically said, yeah, I can't control the inflation that's coming from those issues. And they said, well, but you're going to continue to raise rates. And he sort of said, well, it's the only thing I can do. And I thought, you know, that's not a really good answer. If the Fed starts raising rates here, Jeff, how does that affect supply chain issues that where we're importing inflation from these supply chain issues in Asia and from Ukraine and Western Europe and Eastern Europe?
Inflation's a matter of supply relative to demand, or to put it another way, demand relative to supply. So if the Fed can reduce demand, and keep it in line with supply, you won't have that upward pressure on margins and prices and on supply chains. Disrupted supply chains cause inflation only if the monetary policy authority and fiscal policy authorities haven't calibrated demand to be in line with supply. So there really isn't a dichotomy between types of inflation. It's all demand and supply, or supply and demand.
I'm going to put you back as a voting member of the Federal Reserve Board and put you in that meeting again. What would you argue that the Fed does now?
I think they're raising rates rapidly, and I think they need to do that. I think 50 basis points was the right call. I think signaling 50 basis point moves at the upcoming couple of meetings was the right call. I think they need to be humble about how rapidly they should go and how rapidly they are going to go. I think it would help their case to keep 75 basis points on the table and in play going forward. But more broadly, I think they need to communicate that this is potentially a difficult path ahead. They're going to face a choice where the economy weakens, the labor market weakens, and they're going to get a lot of pressure to back off the fight against inflation. They need to communicate how they're going to play their hand in that situation. And that's the thing that they haven't owned up to. They've sugarcoated the forecast. They've acted as if inflation is going to come down to 2% to near 2% next year, under 2.5% even. The unemployment rate is not going to rise off of historically low levels, and they're only going to have to raise interest rates to 2.5% or so.
Well, I'm not an economist, Jeff, as you well know, but that math doesn't work. I mean,
no, it's you work. Might call it an immaculate disinflation. I mean, it's
immaculate disinflation. I like that.
Yeah. And I don't think it just doesn't seem plausible. And they haven't said what they would do in the scenario in which it doesn't quite come out, you know, so magically wonderful.
Let me throw one other idea at you that I have been discussing. we've had sort of accommodative monetary policy since the great financial crisis, the great banking crisis, great financial crisis, 08 and 09. And we saw things like TARP and TALP when you were on the Fed. And we started this process of quantitative easing. So much of this we hadn't seen before. And I and others, and probably you, but you couldn't say it, others were cautioning, you know, we're doing things now that we haven't done before, and we don't understand fully the potential consequences of this kind of monetary largesse. None of that really got the inflation rate above that 2% target all the way up until 2020, when we hit this pandemic. And the pandemic that caused supply chain issues was also greeted with a fiscal stimulus, where the fiscal side of the house started sending $600 every couple of weeks to every American and $1,400 checks here and there. And with a supply chain, because, so my point is, the Fed wasn't able to really start inflation all the way along. They kind of kept things in GDP dripping along at that 2% rate. We got this perfect storm of the supply chain issues, plus a lot of money going into individual hands. And then we got inflation. So the question is, if we have hit this fiscal cliff, meaning that the fiscal stimulus has stopped, the $600 checks are gone, people have to pay back their student loans, they're facing higher interest rates, they're facing $5.29 a pound butter when they go to the grocery store, and $5 gasoline, isn't there enough perhaps of demand destruction from the current price increases that inflation will roll over largely on its own without too much help from the Fed?
It's true that the fiscal authorities in the United States are not pumping new additional dollars into the system, but the dollars they pumped in weren't all spent. Americans have accumulated a substantial overhang of unspent savings.
You're saying that fuel is still sitting next to the gas,
fuel,
the fire.
Fuel, yeah, exactly. There's fuel sitting out there. You know, people are holding back spending, well, because prices have gone up, because some things aren't available, but also because this is how Americans always react to a sudden one-time fiscal stimulus. You get a tax cut that's temporary. What do? You spend some now, you spend some later, you put some away for spending later. And they've done it again. And so there's still spending in the pipeline owing to the stimulus, even though the dollars are all out the door.
Give us your best case scenario. And, you know, I always learn so much when I get to talk to you. Give us your best case scenario of how this over the next couple of years proceeds. China opens, peace breaks out in Ukraine. What does it take for us to get back to actually go through perhaps the recession? How long will that take till we get there? Really get to that point, constrict to that point of inelasticity and begin to expand again?
It looks like inflation has enough momentum that it's going to stay above 5 or 6 through the end of the year and into next year. 5 or 6% inflation means that any federal funds rate setting below 5% means negative real, that is to say, inflation adjusted interest rates.
Yes.
Which means that the Fed would be, if the funds rate is below 5%, still providing more monetary accommodation than they did early in the pandemic 2 years ago. The Fed's going to have to raise rates to equal the inflation rate in order to start getting inflation down, in my view. So it's going to take nominal interest rates, the federal funds rate, getting up to the neighborhood of what inflation's running
5%? The Fed funds rate's going to 5%, has to get up to 5%.
That would be my best guess.
Wow.
Between now and then, the Fed's going to see weakening in demand, and they're going to be under pressure to accept a higher inflation rate for a while in order to avoid a recession. So we have two scenarios. One is they maintain some backbone and see it through, which involves a recession, maybe a minor one.
Right.
That weakens demand. That shifts labor market dynamics enough that wage setting weakens and wage inflation slows, and you get price inflation slowing on top of that, because yeah, there's supply chain difficulties, but it's hard to sell stuff because consumer sector's weaker.
Just don't have the purchasing power.
And then by 24 or 25, inflation's down under 3%. And then the Fed can loosen and proceed apace. And hopefully inflation expectations are stable at that point. That's one scenario. The second scenario is they back off and they try and fight a recession. And doing that means keeping interest rates too low and tolerating inflation at 4, 5, 6% for a couple of years. And then down the road, they're forced to
do
fight
it all
inflation and try again and take another run of inflation. They'll raise rates and maybe we'll get a recession then, maybe not.
You might want to say that I'm a cynic, Jeff, and you probably, I don't, you know, fine line sometimes between cynic and just a lot of experience. It's hard for me to see a Fed that won't back off. I mean, they've been concerned about markets. They've been concerned about so many things that old Feds weren't concerned about. And Fed chairman used to come out and say, we don't pay attention. I mean, we're not concerned. Our job, our mantra is not the stock market and stock investors. We're looking at, you know, full employment and price stability, and we're not worried about your stock market. They're worried about everything now. I think they worry about everything, and it's become a more political job. What are the odds they don't back off and carry through, or what are the odds that they do back off?
It's a good, really good question. I mean, they've said all the right things about their determination to get inflation down. Chairman Powell has described price stability, getting inflation down, as a prerequisite for maximum employment, suggesting that employment's in the back seat and getting inflation, fighting inflation, is in the front seat. But on the other hand, they've sugarcoated their description of what it's going to take. I mean, they've made it seem like it's painless. They're going to fight inflation by raising rates, but you know,
5%, 5% is going to be very, very painful. We get to 5% Fed funds rates. That's going to be, and that's a recession that everybody's going to feel. So what are the odds? I'm coming back. I know you try. That was not even artful, dancing around that one. 70% chances they back off. Give me over under, more or less.
It's a political calculation. I'm not sure I'm wise enough in the ways of the Beltway to understand that. 50-50 seems like a reasonable enough call to me.
See, that makes you an optimist in my world. an optimist at 50-50. Maybe. That they would be. Yeah, the backing off is what has been their tendency. The backing off is where, you know, is all the political pressure, as you've said, because when they see it weaken, that's when the pressure really gets hot, that they've got to back off. And then you get people saying they're going to fire Jay Powell and they're going to fire whoever doesn't do what they want them to do. And we've seen those appointees. Thank goodness we haven't seen some of the wilder ones get in. So, Jeff, as we go through this as an economist, you know, I have to talk a lot to our investors. Fred and Ethel are my favorite two investors. In their 60s, and they're thinking about their well-being. They're hearing about all of this, and they want to say, Dr. Lacker, do I stay invested through all of this? Do I let time try to carry us through? What do I do?
Yeah, I like the reference to I Love Lucy, you know, right? A favorite of mine. I was glued to that after school, you know, growing up.
You and I both.
Fred and Ethel. I mean, I don't remember them talking investment with Ricky.
No, Fred and Ethel were supposed to be so poor. They owned the damn apartment building in Manhattan. I mean, Fred walking around in his t-shirt, I didn't buy it.
Yeah, so all his money was in real estate. Is that what you're saying?
That's right, dirt poor. That's right.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not going to venture anything on investment advice. I've always stayed away from that. I will stand by the call that things are going to be more volatile coming up than before, because
yes,
markets, you know, this question are, you know, is the Fed going to back off the inflation fight or carry it through? You know, how are they going to react to weakening job growth, weakening consumer spending? That, the uncertainty around that is going to flop markets or back and forth. Unless the Fed gets a lot more clear and a lot more transparent about what they see ahead.
Well, then markets will actually go where the, perhaps they need to go and get it over with. But this seems like a rather painful approach until they come clean, as you said, to stop the sugarcoating. Dr. Jeffrey Lacker is former president of the Richmond Federal Reserve Bank, a former member of the Open Market Committee, voting member. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us again on the Farcast.
My pleasure, Michael.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for us for another week as we do our best to cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world in Washington, D.C. With a great deal of thanks to each of you, I'm Michael Farr. We'll see you next week. Bye.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of the Farcast. Thanks to Michael's guest, Jim Labenthal, Dan Mahaffey, and special guest, Dr. Jeffrey Lacker. The Farcast comes to you weekly and is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and is available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. We love hearing from you every week, and we try to respond to all of your notes and suggestions. You can reach us at hjennings@farmiller.com. Let us know any questions you have and topics you'd like to hear us cover. We would like to remind you that the Farcast podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal or financial advice. The information, statements, comments, views, and opinions expressed or provided in this podcast, including by speakers who are not officers, employees, or agents of Hightower Advisors or Farr, Miller & Washington, are not necessarily those of Hightower Advisors, Farr, Miller & Washington, or any firm any of our guests may represent. Any mention of a specific security should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell, and please be aware that past performance is not a guide to the future performance of any security, index, fund, manager, or strategy. We strongly recommend you review with a financial professional before you make any investment decision. And if we can be of assistance at Farr, Miller & Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are here to help. And I'll be happy to put any of our listeners in touch with one of our investment professionals for a complimentary review of your portfolio and your investment goals. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. Please share the Farcast with friends and colleagues. Go beyond the headlines each week with the Farcast. Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Farr, Miller & Washington is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Some investment professionals may also be registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member of FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. All information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Farr, Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC have not independently verified the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Hightower Advisors, LLC, Farr, Miller & Washington, or any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties expressed or implied as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions or results obtained from the use of this information. Farr, Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates assume no liability for action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to the information. This podcast and the materials contained herein were created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Farr, Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented to entity as tax or legal advice. Clients are urged to consult their tax and or legal advisor for related questions.